The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the programme this Friday, the 1st of May. We're into another month, can you believe? 5 minutes past nine. And we've got a lot coming up on the programme today, including in the second hour, your legal questions answered by our solicitor in residence, Seamus Gunn. So if you have a question, please feel free to get in touch with us now and we'll get those to Seamus, just as many of them actually, in fact, as we can. I'll introduce our Friday panel for you in a moment. Just want to remind you how you get involved in the conversation. 086 60 25000, that's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000, or if you prefer, you can email comments@highlandradio.com. And don't forget, you can watch along on YouTube, on your mobile devices, your smart TV and your Fire Stick, Highland Radio Ireland, and on our Facebook pages. We'll say good morning first to Councillor Thomas Sean Devine, 100% Redress Party Councillor in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. Good morning to you, Thomas.
Good morning, Greg. Good morning to your listeners and Mary Ann Pat as well.
Good to have you with us. Yes, Professor Pat O'Connor, Professor of Sociology, Social Policy Emeritus at University of Limerick. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, all.
Lovely to see you. And Mary Hart, broadcaster and journalist. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Right. Now, this week, the war of words over the defective concrete block scheme reached a new boiling point. Fianna Fáil Councillor Liam Blaney doubled down on his criticism of the 100% Redress Party, accusing them of using negative commentary that's actually discouraging affected homeowners from applying for the current scheme. Councillor Blaney argues that by labelling the scheme not fit for purpose, the 100% Redress Party is causing people to sit in crumbling homes while overlooking the positives and successful cases that are already progressing. On the other side, the 100% Redress Party maintains they are simply highlighting the devastating financial shortfalls that many families still face. So is this political rhetoric around the redress scheme now doing more harm than good? Has the campaign for a better deal reached a point where it's actually deterring people from accessing the help that is currently available? Or is Councillor Blaney's criticism merely an attempt to deflect from the scheme's ongoing flaws? I'll start with you, Councillor Thomas Sean Devine.
Well, Greg, excuse me.
Can I just, by the way, give myself 10 out of 10 for that intro? But carry on, go ahead.
Yeah, Greg, listen, it's not the first time a Councillor Blaney has come out with the same rhetoric in a council chamber, deflecting away from the topic of the day was a motion of no confidence in this government. And I just reflect it back again to attack the 100% Redress Party and others in the chamber. As for a deflection away, as a 100% Redress Party deflecting away, trying to get people to not join the scheme or turning people away from the scheme is totally, totally untrue, Greg. There nothing would be give me the greater pleasure and make me sleep better at night knowing that the 312 people that have come through the scheme so far, that it was a scheme that they were happy. Jake, it's not the full extent, Greg. Out of them 312, the vast majority of them is going to revisit this again. And I hate to say this, Greg. We can't keep going down the road that this scheme is working. I have known two people, Greg, that have come through that didn't have to borrow money or whatever. Now, you need to get on this scheme, Greg. This is where Liam Blaney needs to come out and start telling the truth and his party. Very, very hero of him defending his party all the time, which he's quite entitled to do, Greg. For a fine example now, a £300,000 rebuild. Likelihood you need at least a 10% deposit for your contractor. You'll need the electrician disconnection fees. There's going on. You could probably end up needing 40,000 before you even start. So how is this working for people, Greg? The Redress Party was formed from people that couldn't access this scheme. The failures of two schemes in total, Greg, in 2022 when we formed this party, there was absolutely diabolical things.
But do you think, though, that there is a lot of positives in this scheme?
Greg, I don't see any positives in it.
So with that in mind, then, until such time as the scheme is reviewed, or maybe if Sinn Féin got into power and actually followed through on their commitments, are you suggesting that people should wait before going on the scheme?
Greg, a lot of people have no choice only to
No,
wait
I know,
they...
but I'm not talking about those without a choice. I'm on about talking about those who have a choice.
Well, Greg, I would wait. Personally, would wait, Greg, that there's a far better scheme. But then the longer people's waiting, the price of materials and that has gone up and up and up and up and up.
So,
Greg,
there
was a solution. There was a solution brought forward.
I don't want to be argumentative, but Councillor Blaine is correct then. You are actively discouraging people from going
on
the
scheme. We're not discouraging anybody from doing anything, Greg. There was a people's document was formed a couple of years back ago where the solution was on. Councillor Blaine is constant coming out and saying that we're in that council chamber trying to argue it. We, the people, have went it all in with 81 amendments. Were shot down by our local TDs here as well, government TDs, and a minister at the time. Recent things was brought to them again, shot down. Greg, I'm the chair of the DCB committee for the last 9-10 months. We can't even get the government to answer an email this. It's perfectly designed, probably, Greg, that I leave the chair, that they will come up with something in meetings. They won't meet. The housing minister came up last year, Greg. He hasn't come back since. He told us then he'll be back in a few weeks. We haven't heard tell him. He won't even answer an email to us, Greg. The department was here. We took them to homes here in Letterkenny. They've seen it firsthand. Some of the new people involved in the department couldn't believe their eyes, but they were haven't heard tell him since, Greg. But to say the Redress Party is deflecting or putting people off and joining this game is totally, totally untrue.
I know, but when you are, you're again, right, and you understand that, I understand all the details of this as well, but I have to try and tease this out. You are the chair of the DCB scheme on the council. You're one of the significant founding members of the 100% Redress Party. And when I said to you, you know, should people hold off? You says, well, that's what I would do, right? So that could be that, whether you like how I phrase the question and saying you are discouraging people or not, that would be seen as a discouragement. But I'll come back to you. And you know what? Who's to say that's, I'm not saying that's a bad thing either. It's up to people. Mary Hearts, do you have any sympathy or alliance with Councillor Blaney's comments on this?
Well, I mean, I don't know as much as Councillor Devine would know about this, but I mean, I did hear him just say that people should hold back until they get 100%, which I suppose, interpreting that by Councillor Blaney or Deputy Blaney saying that, then therefore it would mean that he should, you know, it would be interpreted. I believe that people who don't know what to do, because I know that, you know, there are various people advising those who are affected. Because they're in an awful dilemma. I spoke to a lady this week and she said, I have 10% mic in my house, but it's not showing up anywhere. So therefore, I won't get any redress because it has to be falling apart before I do something. And I'm not getting any younger and I want to pass my house on to my family.
Ironically, just in relation to that, that is where we need a bit of progress in the scheme, because that lady with 10% mica in her blocks, if it is actually mica, there needs to be some clarity that her house isn't actually going to potentially fall down around her ears, and
Well, that's what she said. And I mean, it is a desperately, desperately disastrous situation for people to find themselves in, whether it's 10% or 80%, it doesn't matter. I live in Donegal, and we all do. We see the houses falling apart as you're driving along the roads, and it's awful. And I have a certain amount of sympathy, not so much with the government, but with the revenue and having to try and interpret this, because as you've just said, Councillor Devine, that the price of every material is going up and up and up. So if you built your house for 100,000, you know, 10, 20 years ago, and it's 300,000 now, this time next year could be 400,000, and especially the way the economies are moving in the world, global affairs. So, you know, it's a situation that really, really has never been properly clarified. So I think it should be, they shouldn't have to go through hassle. And as far as I understand, every single solitary person who has applied for any redress has got to go through an enormous amount of red tape and a process that's adding to their dilemma. And young kids sitting in a house where, somebody mentioned to me recently they were in bed and from the road you could see the light in their bedroom through the walls. You know, so this is a
and part of that which complicates it even further is Mary, there has been reporting and there is a sense out there that it was purposely made as complicated as actually is.
Yes,
which you hate to think is the case, but when you look at some of the commentary that's been out there at meetings and what have you, I'll come back to you, of course, Professor Pat O'Connor.
Well, I suppose from the outside, Councillor Blaney's comments seem to me to be all about political positioning with a view to the election. So I suppose also from the outside, I still cannot understand how nobody seems to be held accountable for this problem, and how basically, like, there are regulations about everything, and how there are not regulations about the composition of blocks, even yet, it seems to me. I just find the whole thing really, really bewildering. From the point of view of the people involved, it's obviously dreadful. But I mean, in a way, somebody made those bricks, somebody signed off on them. Who did it? And who is accountable?
Yeah, of course, and indeed the oversight that should have potentially and arguably, and I think definitely should have been able to identify that these blocks at that time were of no use. We saw some interesting...
Exactly.
Yeah, we saw some interesting... Well, go on, I'll put another question to you after you come in there, Thomas. I think you wanted to say something.
Yes, Greg. Listen, whilst I says that I would wait, Greg, there's many people out there trying to get on with, and we're helping them every day of the night. And we're always speaking to people morning, noon and night, Greg. My phone's going all morning there with people that wants to get on this scheme. That has got access to money, Greg, that will make a start and get on there. I'll give you an example, Greg. Person I'm speaking to recently, I'll give you two examples, but I'll give you the first one as brief as quick as I can. Speaking to a person recently, built their house 21 years ago, and they took out a mortgage of 90,000. Done a bit of working at themselves, but took out a mortgage of 90,000. Mortgage paid off. The grant they're receiving now, Greg, is 370. The closest quote they got, and they started at their home, is 440. So that's 70-something thousand they've come out with. Not counting, Greg, that replacing their foundations was another 30-something thousand. That's 100,000, Greg, that they're out. But not only that, their mortgage was paid off, Greg. They're now in the well into their 50s that has now come up with, they have to borrow at least another 100,000, starting off from nearly again. This is not right, Greg. This is what's happening every day of the week with people that's getting on the scheme. Now, another example, Greg, how this scheme hasn't worked, and we're going to be revisiting again for the people that recently I visited an older man who took it upon himself to do the outer leaf 5 years ago. The inside of his house is worse than ever the outside of his house was, Greg. This is again where this scheme is not working for the vast majority of people. You know, I can't reiterate it enough, Greg. This is not politics to us. We were born out of pure frustration, Greg, this party. We come from all different backgrounds, different political beliefs and a whole lot. I was elected along with three amazing people who, there's no question that it worked tremendously hard on every issue going in that council chamber and every issue, everyday life. Most of my work, Greg, is about people being evicted, failures of this government again, the rent. We all know the price of rent on that. Landlords now selling up, didn't sign up to this new rental scheme. So they say that once this scheme sorted out or whatever and people get on with life, there's no more call for the redress party, which I hopefully there's not, Greg, but we do work on every issue that's going, not just effective blocks. But as I say, I'll let you carry on, Greg, and I'll come back in.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I'm going to move on anyway, unless either of our ladies wish to comment anything further. I'm going to take a break and we'll move on. We'll probably end up coming back to this through listeners' comments in any case, but just for this segment. Mary, Pat?
Yeah, well, I mean, what Pat has just said, I totally agree. You know, there's somebody has been responsible for this. Now, I know it was self-regulation. The council should have been testing and checking. But from what I gather, and I don't know if this is the fact, you know, that the government, central government, did not provide the finances for the council to have a staff to go out and do that. I don't wear that, but I don't know if that's correct. And you know, I suppose Councillor Devine would know if that is the case or not. But the council are responsible, whether we like it or not. And so are the company that's produced these blocks. And, you know, we, the taxpayers, are obviously footing the bill, which means there's money going to this scheme that should be going somewhere else and then another, you know.
And that's why it's so important for everyone across the country to have an interest in this, because, you know, that taxpayers' money went into doing the outer leaf of that home that Thomas mentioned earlier, and now the inside is gone. We are currently, unless you have the resources, building new houses on, you know, Weetabix blocks foundations. That's not a good use of public money either. Okay, our call, our text, sorry, 086 6020 6025000. There, the government has confirmed a major policy shift this week, announcing plans to withdraw state funding or state-provided commercial accommodation for around 16,000 Ukrainians who arrived before March 2024. Alongside this, the accommodation recognition payment to Irish hosts is set to be wound down by next year. While the Taoiseach maintains the move is about transitioning towards independence, it's been condemned as unethical by the Labour Party and the Social Democrats. Professor Pat O'Connor, is this the right move now at the right time?
Well, I suppose on the one hand, it's clear that it is a move that is in tune, I'm speaking kind of ironically, with popular sentiment. And so there's an element of political posturing about it. On the other hand, this was a temporary arrangement. And it did create a divide in the system between those who came in from Ukraine and other international protection asylum seekers. And the fact that one group of these were largely white, and the other group weren't, I think, has created a tension and an unease. And so, in a way, the system had to end whereby one group who were coming from a difficult situation were being clearly favoured over another group who were also coming from difficult situations.
But they
situation.
Still will be clearly favoured because they can move freely into this country and live and work, even if they're not receiving supports from the state, whereas some of the people you referenced there, of course, can't. They still have to go into accommodation and try and seek the right to work here or indeed citizenship.
Yes, and I think, though, that this is the beginning of a change of policy. Well, it's a continuation of a change of policy, really, since there was the cuts from 800 to 600 for hosts has already happened. And in a way, it reflects the fact that we're living in a world where politically difficult situations are created for individuals with disastrous consequences. I did note the minister's observations that we will not be removing people or taking away accommodation where people need our support. And I think it would be very helpful to clarify what exactly she means by that.
I think really obviously, you know, of all the people, say, for instance, here from Ukraine, many now are living and working and renting in the private sector. Clearly, they really don't no longer need support because the level playing field has to be with Irish people who are living here as well. But there are going to be those who can't work for various reasons. Presumably, that those are the cohort that they're talking about continuing to support.
Well, yeah, but for example, women with small children, obviously, they're in a situation where they need, until the children are a bit bigger, they will need support. It's not clear if those will be included. Roughly a third of all the Ukrainians, the figures say, are in paid employment. And so, in a way, it is easy to envisage that they might be applying for citizenship and moving down that road. But I suppose one of the things that is striking is the government hasn't really thought through, I would think, the full consequences. For example, many rural schools have been, quote, rescued by Ukrainian children. If the children are basically moved or if the arrangements change, obviously a lot of schools, small schools, are going to be in difficulties. In the cost of living situation, many people who were getting the tax-free host monies are going to be in a difficult situation when those are cut and ultimately withdrawn next March. So there are a lot of knock-on consequences for this decision that I'm not convinced the government has thought through or put in place measures to actually deal with it.
I suppose they've bought themselves time, but it's a very interesting angle on it. Mary Hart, what do you think? Is this the proper move from government moving towards long-term integration, or is there something else going on?
Well, I wouldn't imagine there's anything else going on other than the government. This is just a most difficult situation. It's just never going to be easily administered. As we all know, when the war happened in Ukraine, everybody opened their doors, who could open their doors and brought Ukrainians in. They were, you know, warmly welcomed and rightly so. So you have a two-track situation in Ireland where people coming from Ukraine were facilitated as best they could because they were fleeing, you know, the chance of an explosion happening tomorrow or you know, that day. So, you know, you have a situation where, you know, a lot of people in local and in little villages and in large towns around Ireland, you know, there's a lot of the hotels have taken up by Ukrainian refugees. Tourists aren't coming in to those towns because there is no accommodation for them. Then the government are trying to clamp down then on other provisions such as the Airbnb. And so, you know, where are the tourists going to stay if there are no... Now, this isn't about tourism and this isn't about people having a wonderful time on their holidays, but it still is a lot of money coming into our... It's one of our biggest money spinners, you know, with
but
tourism.
Why now, though, Mary? Because, you know, the situation hasn't improved in Ukraine. It's pretty much the exact same this week as it was 4 weeks after... Yeah. Russia's invasion. So why is the need less now for Ukrainians? Why are we doing this now, do you think?
Well, I mean, you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to look at other countries now that are in conflict. I mean, why should we not be taking anybody from Palestine who is fleeing? You know, you have a situation where the world in the Middle East, no one could have predicted that was suddenly going to explode. And yes, the Ukrainian war is still going on. And yes, those people who fled are still entitled to our help. But a hotel accommodation isn't the way to do that. And, you know, there is a big issue with whoever has, I mean, the Red Cross were one of the administrators of that scheme at the time. And, you know, so you had people... You know, you have a lot of people made a lot of money out of this. And I think that's one of the sour grapes of all of this. And I think that's, you know, that is to the core of it, that people are like...
Well, see, that's the thing. I don't think a lot of people made a lot of money out of it. I think
a certain amount of people
in the know made an awful lot of money. Did you want, before I go to Thomas, did you want to come back in there, Pat?
No, okay, not at the moment.
I'm looking straight into your eyes and trying to read what you might be thinking.
Sorry. Yeah.
Thomas Sean Devine, is this the right move from government at the right time?
Greg, my own honest and personal opinion on it is it probably could have been handled a lot better, but it was always only going to be a temporary measure. And as you quite rightfully pointed out, Greg, there was a small cohort of people made an awful lot of money tax-free out of this. You know, and it wasn't about helping people. I don't believe in their court. It was about making millions. You know, like a fine example here, Greg, recently was dealing with a girl, I have to say an Irish girl here in Letterkenny, and, you know, she was living next door to two Ukrainians, and she couldn't ask for two nicer neighbours, to be quite honest, Greg. They would have done anything for her. This girl was struggling, had to pay her full rent, and she wasn't getting any help at all. The two Ukrainian people, lovely people they are, Greg, doing a lot for society here. You were earning a good wage, but they were still getting us €800, which wasn't fair when you looked at the girl next door who was struggling. You know, I do believe, Greg, personally.
It did. I think what that did is it did stoke bad feeling where bad feeling never ordinarily would ever have existed.
Yes. I think, Greg, I think if people, anybody knows me, Greg, knows I'm on for helping everybody, no matter where they're from or what colour their skin is, whatever. I think, Greg, what happens is if there's people here and they're working and they're earning 11 grand, they shouldn't be getting us €800 or €600 towards their rent. You know, I think that needs to stop in all cases, Greg, you know. And there is plenty of work about, you know, and I think if people's here, Greg, and they're out actively working, there's one gentleman, he's quite heavily in the high profile this last while here in the town, Oleg. A lot of work done with Letterkenny Cathedral Quarter, Letterkenny Teddy Towns. The man's a gentleman. He's here 4 years from Ukraine, you know, and his wife's working and Penny. That gentleman has got on the society here that is well respected and is well liked, and he got to switch the lights on the Letterkenny Theatre, a church lane there the other night, which was a fitting tribute to him, Greg, you know. But to come back to the area about the payments and the government cutting them, Greg, I would fully support, Greg, that those that can pay should pay their own way here. By all means, open their arms and welcome them all here, Greg, but if they can pay their own way, pay it. And if if the, those just vulnerable still need help, Greg, I think we should.
Okay, well, there are people who, and right wing, by the way, isn't a slur. There's left wing, right wing, centrist. I'm not saying far right. I'm talking right wing here. So people who are right leaning, anti-immigration, had serious concerns about immigration, have been saying the same stuff that we're just saying now from the get-go, really effectively. And many of them stood on that platform. Very, very few of them were elected. Are we seeing a situation, Mary Hart, I'll come to you first on this, that even though the public didn't necessarily vote anti-immigration or people with reservations about immigration into government, that section of society, or that those people with that view seem to actually be influencing, and there was actually a study suggested this, seem to be influencing, you know, cabinet policy. It's an interesting observation, even if it's just part of everyday life.
Yeah, I mean, we all have our opinions. That's, you know, social media has been the ogre in the world affairs, and if it wasn't for social media, Donald Trump wouldn't have been elected, and perhaps you know the war in Ukraine may not have advanced to the extent it did. Personally, there is strong influences in this country that we don't like. We have no way of proving it, but we know it's there, and the people who are researching it know that it's there, which is, you know, right-wing forces that are peddling anti-immigration. I mean, it's horrific.
Yeah, but that's my point. The government really is only doing now what the people that you say aren't supported have been suggesting for years.
Well, what do you mean? You mean that people don't want refugees here? You know, the refugees are people, Irish people are welcome.
No, my point is yes, of course. And if you look at the results of the election,
yeah.
If you look at the result of the election, there was not a massive move towards anti-immigration candidates. So,
yeah.
Right? So you would argue then that that's the public's democratic will has spoken. But what my question is the government seems to still be influenced, though, by anti-immigration, more right-wing commentary, even though the public didn't vote for that per se, if that makes sense.
I know what you're saying, and I don't agree with what you're saying, because I don't believe that the government, that there is those right-wing forces influencing the decision on, particularly on taking refugees out of the accommodations that they're in now.
The case, then why is Jim O'Callaghan doing these high-profile, extradition flights, telling the press so they're there and all the pictures are taken and sending them out, and definitely a change in language. Language, as I say, would have been described as far right 2 or 3 years ago. You know, I mean, I'm only saying what I'm seeing.
Well, I think that the whole immigration situation hadn't been tackled properly. I mean, it's not that terribly long ago that when we even allowed refugees coming into Ireland, because, well, nobody wanted to come in and we couldn't afford to have people. We are a very, very, very rich country in the terms of per head of population and income. People will argue, well, not everybody's getting that money, but per head of our population we are, and we have, and we should be taking in refugees, but it has been badly, badly structured. And that, I believe, is the problem, that the government, and particularly Jim O'Callaghan, is actually starting to tackle that situation in the best way possible. And I wouldn't put it down to that he's just trying to appease or be influenced by right-wing activists. And again, the same as the oil issue, and the petrol issue, I don't believe that the government were influenced greatly by that. There's certainly there is an influence, but they stood firm, and rightly so. So I think Jim O'Callaghan is a very good minister in what he is attempting to do. He's trying to put the situation in as fair and balanced a way, so that we can all accept that we are getting, and everybody else is getting, a fair amount of the exchequer money.
Professor Pat O'Connor, what do you believe?
Yes. Yeah, I would tend to agree to disagree with Mary and to agree with you, Greg. I think there is an element of that pandering to the right. The Hope and Courage study that you were referring to showed that something like 66% of the Irish population welcomed people coming, refugees, asylum seekers or whatever. But the government, I suppose several things have changed as well, in that the war in the Middle East and the increasing cost of living is putting pressure on the government. It is clear to everyone on the ground that there are anomalies. happening in terms of the way the rules are being applied, both to Ukrainians, to Irish people, and to international protection applicants. And that is irritating people in the context where they're themselves under financial pressure. The government then is kind of wanting to and anticipating. There's also a kind of an impatience with the government because, to be honest, since it was elected, they have made a series of strategic boo-boos, for want of a better word, and their action hasn't been impressive. Their delivery hasn't been impressive. And I'm not the only one saying this, right? So people are getting a bit frustrated and annoyed with the politicians, with both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And so in this situation, the government is thinking, gosh, how are things going to go at the next election? There is also the fact that the government saying, the minister saying, encouraging Ukrainians to live independently. The big problem there is housing.
Just in relation to the government, this is all the same type of conversation I was hearing 2 years before the last election. And yet, lo and behold, the public went out and they returned Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Both parties did far better than anyone would imagine. They also managed to get together a group of independents where they can easily survive any vote of no confidence. So, you know, there's obviously enough people out there that actually vote that are content. Why would they pander to anyone? Thomas, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I don't. Oh, I mean, I think the government is doing what it should be doing, which is running the country, and that's what they're supposed to do. And every action that they take isn't based around the fact that they're pandering to the public to get re-elected. Governments do things when they're in power and they do things that are unpopular. And I think this government has done things that are unpopular. And just because they do that, what I would regard as putting things to right at the moment and beginning that process, that doesn't mean to say they're doing that because they're pandering to the right or because they want to get elected again. Of course they want to get elected again. That's what their task is in hand. All politicians do their best to make sure that people, what they do, that they please the people who voted for them. And I don't see that there is a pandering by the government to right-wing forces. They stood very firm on the protests,
I just would dispute that with you because I think they were. I actually think the protests brought the government to the table, and they ended on a Friday or a Saturday, and the government announced measures on a Monday or Tuesday.
Well, but then you have the people like me who got stuck in the middle of it all. Traveling for hours on end from Dublin, I just couldn't understand it. I got stuck in Letterkenny as well. I mean, there are ways of protesting, and if I want to block a road tomorrow, I can't do that. So you cannot do that. You cannot act illegally. And I don't believe that is what forced the government. It certainly brought it to the attention generally that something had to be done. And I suppose listening to the oil, the delivery oil companies here saying that they would be putting their prices up in anticipation, that irked an awful lot of people. It irked me at the time because I thought, well, so that's what they do. Shouldn't be doing that.
Thomas, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, Gary, I'll have to disagree with Mary there regarding the protest. And I think it was ordinary working people that felt that they had to come to the street, regarding the protest because nobody was listening, Greg, and the price of fuel had just rocketed sky high there, heating oil, it's shocking. I'm glad to see a better warm weather now for the vast majority of people that can survive. There was no measures put in place. The government done very little at the time now, and I think the protesters did bring them out, and even though the government probably not admit to that, and then threatening the ordinary people, they're bringing the Gardaí and the army, and was absolutely wrong. I think it was a wrong decision to make. When we had four protesters and a couple of TDs going to the door to get and have a meeting and then to be turned away was wrong as well. The situation could have been diffused a lot sooner and a lot more could be done to reduce heating oil. It's a major, major talking point at the moment, the price of heating oil. As I say, I'm glad the weather's got a wee bit better. But going back to the Ukrainian issue, Greg, we have two by-elections coming up, and was this announcement prompted for them, for the two by-elections, to prop up support for the government? Probably the likelihood was to a certain extent. But again, Greg, going back to helping people, There's been no houses built in this country for 10 or 15 years, and that's where we felt we're feeling a pinch now, the housing crisis. We have announcements every year from government that they built 40 and 50,000, 30,000 houses. Like, you know, I'm sitting here nearly, Craig, beside a site that was announced back in January, 50 million.
And I'm not being facetious, but they just haven't, just because they haven't built them outside your house doesn't mean they haven't built them either. Like, there's a lot of apartments, Craig, and houses. I mean, those figures are.
Yeah,
whether
Greg,
they're enough or not, they have
Greg,
built.
You know, before the last election, Greg, that they announced that there was 40-something thousand houses built. And after the election, it turned out, Greg, there was only 30,000. You know what I mean? We have all these announcements, Greg, all the time. But listen, it's not announcements. We need just houses on the ground, and we need them speeded up, like, you know, and that's what's needed. Like, and we wouldn't be in a crisis. But going to the Ukrainian issue, people felt, Greg, that there was a lot of people getting put on the air where we hadn't got the services to host them people. And I think them was mistakes that was all made. There's probably parts of this country that could have held a lot more people than certain parts, and people wasn't being moved under that.
The one thing in all of this, it always happens, and it's when we seem to be talking about a group of people, is that it's very likely or possible that the vast majority of Ukrainians believe now that they have received enough support. You know, we always talk about the government are deciding this, and then we, the public, speak. And we never actually speak to the people. We spoke to Max, actually, during the week, and he says, yeah, you know, I'm in a position now whereby, you know, I can survive here on my own. So maybe, you know, we never hear those voices, which is unfortunate. Okay, now, thank you for all of your texts and comments coming in. We're still in the company of our Friday panel, of course. Just in relation to DCB there. Hi, Paul here. I believe the Mica people, DCB, should try push on with the work on their houses. It's quite unreal such a vast amount of money is currently available to get this work done. And also they need to push on while they have the support of the people. Both could change. That's not saying I don't feel for their cause. I definitely do. But in different times, they'd be lucky to get new walls. Many now moving into new energy efficient homes. Many say they have spent additional money. But if the before and after specs are looked at, it's easy to explain. Greg, I'm in the middle of my rebuild. My foundations were tested to be defective and had to be removed at my own cost. This placed us in a situation where we had to build to modern standards. We're currently at €30,000 above the scheme and are looking at another 30 spend on top of that. The 100% redress party is the only party who are actively fighting for people not even able to get to the position we are in. The government have no empathy whilst building costs rise, so does the cost to the victims' mental and physical health. Councillor Blaney and co. have no empathy and do not listen, but only pretend to. Just look at housing, health, education, law and order, and when it comes to Donegal, they have no sympathy either, as the electorate have rejected them. I will say, he's not here to defend himself, but Councillor Blaney said in his comments yesterday, whether you agree with him or not, that he is also one of those trying to improve the scheme and recognises that it's not for everyone, but wanted to point out, I think, that it is good for some, and that's really what we've been debating here and there. Right, now, a cloud of public distrust hangs over the long-awaited Buncrana nursing home project following revelations that the community may have been misled regarding the scale of the facility. Concerns have peaked after it emerged that the proposed number of beds does not appear to be based on a formal assessment of the actual clinical need for the Inishowen area, but rather on pre-existing, potentially outdated figures, which I found amazing. So with the HSE under fire for providing bad information to the public, many locals feel this is yet another example of a box-ticking exercise rather than a genuine attempt to address the elderly care crisis in Donegal. We don't know. There's no accountability as to how these errors were made. This feels like a local version to some extent of the children's hospital. I'll bring you in relation to that. And I don't mind if you marry the two, Professor Pat O'Connor, because there is a sort of a scaled similarity, it feels.
Well, I did look up what was happening on the Buncrana nursing home. And I suppose, to be honest, it appears that HICWA said there was 30 beds, and this 41 is explained by double counting of 11 beds in the Ash ward. Quite honestly, if there is somebody in the HSE who can't count up to 41, they shouldn't be in their job. And the person who signed off, we all know that a hierarchical system exists. So it's not only somebody at the bottom made the mistake, but somebody several steps up signed off on it. So I am a believer in public accountability and actually naming the people who sign off on these mistakes, inverted commas. I think it's absolutely, it destroys public trust. It makes a farce of data. So that's the first problem. And this is without even taking into account the point that what is and is there a needs-based analysis of how many beds are needed?
Well,
anyway?
There isn't. And we were speaking to a representative of the IHA during the week, and they said it could be 100, it could be 150, it could be 75. It was said that, well, you could have 100 beds and it might not be enough one time, and it won't be enough another. I understand it was a conversation where casual language can be used, but this is life and death.
Not rocket science, you know, like there are figures on every basically the age profile of areas. There are percentages of people who will need, who it's known will need residential care. Now, I am, by the way, in favor of much greater expenditure on ensuring that people remain in the community, enhanced domiciliary care packages, because in a way we saw during COVID, one of the things we saw was the sheer catastrophic nature of putting people into residential care in times of COVID because infection spreads. But this is not rocket science, you know, to actually have demographic predictions of how many people in an area will need supported living, how many people will need. I mean, I actually worked, would you believe it, in the 70s in London when this was actually being done. So this is crazy. Mm. And I do think that people just need not to accept this kind of ridiculous explanations. There are, you know, it's not rocket science to work out these things.
It was human error. It was human error. We put our hands up. It was a mistake. I asked, well, who signed off on that mistake? Well, you know, hands up. You know, it was a mistake. But this chips away at trust. Mary Hart, what's your view?
Yeah, I mean, it's appalling, and Bunkran is very close to my heart because I spent 5 years living there when I was in boarding school, and I have a lot of very good friends. In fact, I was there yesterday evening with some of my friends, and we're all at an age, we agreed, you know, that demographic is, you know, there's people living longer, they're healthier, but there's still going to be a big demand. And I agree with you, Greg. Accountability in this country doesn't exist. And even for myself, I find I have resorted to a freedom of information question to a specific department to try and pinpoint the actual person who did what they did, because they hide behind, you know, a group meeting or somebody signed off on it, and the signing off person wasn't the person who made the decision. It's appalling, but it doesn't surprise me that this would happen in Bunkrana. It has happened in Lifford, in the hospital where I was born. A perfectly good hospital was shut down despite enormous public outcry about it and protests nonstop. And they have huge, strong campaigners in Bunkrana, and I give them full credit for demanding that this hospital is built properly, extended properly. And from what I gather, it's, you know, half of it is closed down because of this.
As well as that, there is no plan. There is no plan for Inishowen.
Yes,
to enhance bed capacity. No plan.
Yeah, there's no plan, in my view, across the country where the HSE are involved. And we all know that, you know, those of us old enough, you know, when we had our regional health boards, they knew exactly what was needed in the area. The Northwestern Health Board was made up of local people and councillors, okay. And they knew what was what, but okay. That has not happened. And you have managers sitting in an office in Dublin making decisions on a map, pointing how many beds you would create. And as I say, Lifford is sitting there, perfectly good place, and it's lying empty when there's such a demand for proper accommodation.
Thank you so much. Last word to you, Thomas Sean Devine, councillor. Unless you unmute, we're not going to have that last word.
Sorry, Greg. No, I have to agree with Mary and Pat there, what both of them have said. You know, it's absolutely diabolical. And Greg, like 7 years waiting and then to be told 41 beds. and then 30 beds now. There was 30 beds now, possibly going to be 35. We only have to look at Little Angel School here in Letterkenny. We knew 3 or 4 years before it was built it was going to be too wee. You know, when Donaghy was built, it's still too wee. Good news this week that there is another classroom being made available. But as Mary White pointed out, Clifford Hospital was closed. You know, I know there's a new one getting built now up on this new site, but still it was closed down. Greg did need to be closed. Large campaigns for that hospital as well. And again, you
Okay.
know, we had no
Just in relation to that, lots of people were asking, can you find out the breakdown between long-term and short-term respite beds, re these 36 beds? We did try and find out, but it has not been decided yet, as the HSC needs to work with HICWA further down the line. So still uncertainty. Councillor Thomas Sean Devine, enjoy your weekend. Thank you so much for your
Thank
time. I
you,
really
Greg.
do appreciate it, as I do appreciate the time, as always, of Mary Hart. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, Greg. Good
Look after
morning.
yourself and our own professor, Professor Pat O'Connor. Thank you very much indeed, Professor. Enjoy your weekend.
And you, Greg.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, that was our Friday panel. I will get to your comments, of course, which have been coming in thick and fast. Let me get to some comments, and we're going to play a wee clip also too of our podcast, which is being released for you at 11 o'clock. That's going to come up after the next break, and then we'll go straight into Seamus Gunn then, thereafter answering your legal questions. I totally disagree with Mary Hart. Finding the person means the young admin person is used as a scapegoat for the higher up, well paid individual who will never be held accountable. We are human. We can all make mistakes. And that is your good nature kicking in there. And I get that. And I feel that too. And when I call for accountability, it is always something I feel a little bit awkward in doing so. But it's not literally a person. Like that, if it was one individual, there is someone over them eventually, effectively, that presumably has to take responsibility. It's the exact same here. If there's a mistake made here in the newsroom, I'm the head of news. Eventually, you know, ultimately, it's my fault. And I can't say, well, I, you know, it's nothing to do with me. They made it a mistake. Well, it's my responsibility to ensure those mistakes aren't made. And that's just the kind of accountability that you don't see in the HSE. But I do get where you're coming from. There is that sense that, you know, some poor person if we go down that route, there'll never be answers to anything at all, will there? Greg, regarding the person with 10% mica and has damaged or has not damaged, the Banking Payment Federation of Ireland has stated it's organising a technical group to devise a way of providing mortgages on undamaged homes. Many have a 10% plus mica on homes standing 40 years undamaged. The Council DCB committee heard this from BPFI in January. I know, but if you are trying to sell your house, forget about it being mortgaged. If you're trying to sell your house currently, and, you know, someone comes and says, you know, have you had the house tested? And you get, yep, it's got 8% mica, but there's no issue whatsoever. There are still lots of people call it the mica crisis. And there is nothing currently in place to reassure a potential buyer. We're not all in the know. And it's not always people who own the property that might be seeking to remortgage or what have you. So it does require further clarity far beyond what the Banking and Payments Federation of Ireland, I think, is looking at. I disagree very much with Councillor Blaney. My house is crumbling. My three kids are in college in Dublin. We are both professionals. Our home is for knocking down. We've had a number of prices to rebuild the same thing, and the cost coming to us with the grant is €120,000 extra. We simply cannot educate our children, keep them in Dublin and rebuild. Homes in Malahide and Dublin were crumbling and they were fully rebuilt without any hassle or cost to them. Why is Donegal homeowners any different? Can someone tell me why? Can someone tell me when? Why government won't release money to local councils to repair social housing at the moment? It's only private homes. Looks like we're not in it all together at all. This delay to a redress scheme for council houses. It's you know, we've been promised it and promised it. It's coming soon, and yet here we are. A lot of people will agree with you. On the issue of Ukraine, Ireland, Irish are the most caring and generous people in the world, but it's always been a temporary situation that made a few people very rich, and the government now knows that they have reached their limits in eyes of the Irish people. Unfair treatment. It's government policy, not the people, always has been. Another, it's time they paid for their own lodgings. We have to. I know one Ukrainian who's complaining she will have to start paying rent, but this year alone, she's had three holidays away, even to Greece and back home, and is not happy. I'm Irish and I can't even go on one holiday. It's time to sort this out. and other foreign nationals are welcome, the asylum system and allowing migrants into Ireland in very large numbers is untenable. By allowing this, it puts our own people to the bottom of the line, reported in putting foreign nationals to the foreign. Irish people need to the front, is it they mean? Irish people need to be looked after, and then everyone else after that, making sure that we've the appropriate infrastructure in place to deal with foreign nationals. I don't actually believe, firstly, I don't think there's a country in the world that could say, right, we've looked after everyone here, now we'll start looking after others. I think it's the balance, it's the pie, and how that pie is distributed. You know, it's always going to have to be done, two things going at the same time. It's getting that balance right so it seems fair. On the Children's Hospital, I remember when the Children's Hospital was first announced, a developer in Dublin wanted to build a Children's Hospital and a maternity hospital for 600 million, and he was turned down. We are a laughing stock. On the cost of living, morning Greg, not one mention from your panel of all the Irish people struggling with housing, doctor's appointment, fuel prices, ESB prices, etc. The recent peaceful protests with the army and the guards on the street. Once again, this proves what the government think of the Irish people. Money and help for everyone else but the Irish people. It's not the panel's fault. We put the questions together. We did the cost of living, ESB prices, housing. We do that all of the time. And, you know, if you listened every single week and it was the same matters all of the time, it might become hard to listen to. Great panellists, fingers on the pulse, underlying thread, government incompetence, two flawed defective block schemes, shambolic Ukrainian and asylum schemes, housing crisis, health crisis, can't get Children's Hospital finished. You may say the government parties were returned the last election. They might not run their term and might not get in the next time. That comes in from Liam. Yes, Liam, and I'm not... I want to spit in facts, as they say, you know. All I remember in the run-up to the last election was this presumption, and every comment, the presumption was is that the government certainly cannot be returned. And I said at the time, I says, this is not a fait accompli. You can't presume that that's the case, because you have to also look at what the opposition is offering, and is it real change, and do people trust that they can make the fulfil the promises that they were? And then, you know, we've got a multi-tiered society where there are some people extremely well off, there are some people, you know, comfortable, and then there's a whole quarter of people who are in poverty, who are struggling. The reality is too, you see, those less likely to vote are those people that are struggling and in poverty. That is a fact. It's not just anecdotal, it is a fact. So all of that contributes. Okay, when the changes were made to the programming here on Highland Radio, it allowed us a little bit more time to focus on a podcast, a sister podcast to this radio show. It's called The Greg Hughes Podcast. It's available for you every week from 11 a.m. on our website, highlandradio.com, on Spotify, and also on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. We're about 17, 18 episodes in, and I will say, and I don't mind saying it, we've spoken to some incredibly interesting people, from pop music to, you know, dealing with tragedy and coping with tragedy, to trying to highlight some lesser known issues to try and bring greater public awareness out there. And coming up, I spoke recently, actually, to an amazing gentleman from Bundoran who's 96. He's 96 in about 10 days. And he's living in Australia, and he moved out to Australia many, many moons ago. But he's really made a huge impact over there in tourism and charity and all that type of stuff. And I had this wonderful opportunity to chat to that gentleman. So that's coming up in a future episode. But what about today at 11 o'clock? Well, imagine being told your physical organs are shutting down, but it's all in your head. This week on the Greg Hughes Podcast, we sit down with Rosemary McFadden and Sharon Flanagan to discuss a rare life-altering autoimmune condition that almost cost Rosemary her life, Alison's disease. What started as a harrowing journey of medical misdiagnosis ended in a miraculous chance meeting between the two women in Letterkenny, who became each other's greatest support. And here is just a sample of the start of that conversation. Right, I'm joined on the podcast by Sharon Flanagan and Rosemary McFadden. Thank you very much for joining us. Right, so we're talking about Alison's disease, and I have both of you in front of me, and you both look fantastic and healthy. Is that part of the problem, in that sometimes that's the perception of it?
That's 100%. People will look at you, even family members, and they'll say, wow, God, you look you look so well. And that's probably part of the steroid that makes you look so well, because steroid gives you a high colour. It makes you, and you feel good if you if you're taking the right amount and you're taking mm-hmm. your proper medication. But when you feel unwell and people don't see you, that's when you look really, really unwell. And that's mm-hmm. what we were just chatting about there, Sharon.
That's what we always talk about.
That's your experience as well.
That's definitely my experience. So sometimes you feel that people don't believe, you know, that you're experiencing such symptoms. And when you present to, say, at the start, present as a GP and would have lost an extreme amount of weight and the fatigue, and they kind of, because they're very non-specific symptoms, the GP kind of, you know, it's hard for them, but they can assess it as more anxiety-based. But actually, it's a very life-threatening condition. And once you get the right medicine and you're on the right dosage, you can live a very good life. But it's up and down every day, because as a normal person, you can... you know, you yourself will produce cortisol as it's needed during the day, whereas myself and Rosemary have to administer the amount we think we need during the day. Now, there's a standard sort of physiological dose that you would take that would kind of cover everybody. But if you get bad news, or say, you know, your child is sick, or even say you're sick yourself, you know, say you get an infection, the steroid you take actually covers it. So sometimes you don't even know you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
You could,
but if you have a very bad episode, Sharon, it can get very serious very quickly.
Oh God, yeah.
Be it a physical or an emotional trigger.
Exactly. Now the thing with it is because there's not a lot of research done on it, and there's about, I think it's about between 2,000 and 3,000 people in Ireland that have it. And it was kind of remarkable how I met Rosemary. We were working together, and one day I had noticed that she had been taking hydrocortisone, which is the hormone that I take. And I thought, because anybody I ever spoke to and I said, I have Addison's disease, they kind of went, you don't know what that is. But I said, have you a condition, an autoimmune condition? And she said, yeah, but I have a really rare one. You probably never heard of it. And then she said, Addison's disease, and my jaw dropped. You know, I thought, but she was managing so well. And I had newly been diagnosed at that time. And I thought, oh, this is great, because there's light at the end of the tunnel, because I had 12 adrenal crises in that year. I had been in A&E for... by ambulance, I don't know how many times, and it's very traumatic for children to see it, because, you know, once you lose the ability to produce cortisol and you don't know, you know, are you taking too much or too little, you collapse. Yeah. So that's the
And you can end up in a coma, and it can be incredibly...
And it can be fatal, yeah. Which is probably, you know, it drives anxiety through the roof. And I do understand when GPs say, look, this time it's just anxiety, but I have learned over the... I was diagnosed in 2015. So I have learned over that course of time, and so has my husband. I have a husband that is very aware now because, you know, of the condition I have, when it's serious and when it's not serious.
Mm. He's like one of those clever dogs that can almost smell something's up, is it?
He just knows. I'm with him nearly 30.
He just knows you inside out.
I'm nearly 30 years with him, so he knows this one's serious. Okay. And
because it's triggered by anxiety, or it can be a crossover, it's like... Anyway, we'll dig into that a bit more. Rosemary, 14 years you've had your diagnosis, but how long have you been suffering the impacts of Addison's?
So I was working in Dunn's, and I remember I would maybe move from my checkout and I would go down the floor, and the sweat would be lashing off me. Mm. And I would go upstairs because I felt uncomfortable, and I would go upstairs, and maybe if somebody was walking along with me, they'd be talking to me, and I'd be going and out of breath, and I thought, God, this is really weird.
And you can hear much more from both ladies in that podcast. And you know, an awful lot of medical conditions, and it seems to be those particularly, although Addison's is not gender specific, that particularly affect women, whereby, like, both of those ladies ended up being sent for psychiatric assessment. Such was the distrust of what they were saying about how they were feeling and what have you. I mean, can you imagine that? Telling your families, there's no shame in that, but these people are, these ladies have a physical illness and they're being sent to a psychiatrist to figure out if they're presumably making it all up in their head or however it might have been diagnosed. Okay, so that was just a sample of that podcast for you. Two very interesting women. And it just is another example, isn't it, of almost invisible conditions that people tolerate, you know, very, very serious conditions that have a huge impact on your life and leave you on medication and trying to balance medication for the longest of times for the entirety of your life. But in any case, two very interesting ladies. I think I enjoyed the conversation very much. You can hear it in its entirety from 11 a.m. So you can listen, in other words, whenever you wish later on. Stick around for John Breslin and the rest of the guys as well, of course. But when it suits you, you can download it and listen to whenever you like. Or it's on Spotify and iTunes. The whole back catalogue of podcasts are there. They come out every Friday, and they're also alongside the podcast of this show, which comes out every day. Okay, so there's loads of stuff there for you if you want to have a listen whenever it suits you. Okay, after the break, Seamus Gunn is going to be answering legal questions.
The Greg Hughes Show with City of Derry Airport. Experience the magic of Lapland this Christmas. This action-packed one-day trip is taking off 18th of December with a full itinerary of festive activities and memories to cherish with your little ones. Visit cityofderryairport.com.
Hello, Donegal. Max Roddy here. I'm bringing my debut show, Peter Pan, the tour that never grew up, to Anne Greenan Theatre, Letterkenny, on Friday, May 1st. Perfect timing for your bank holiday weekend. If you're up for a night of belly laughs, mad tales and pure crack, you'll love it. Tickets are moving fast, so grab yours today at Anne Greenan Theatre.
There's deals to treat yourself to this week at Dunn Stores. Refresh with selected 7-Up Pepsi and Club 18-pack range, only €10 each. Enjoy selected Hunky Dories and Tato 6-packs, My Waddy 1-litre Coca-Cola and 7-Up 2-litre range. Mix and match any 3 for €5. And pick up selected O'Donnell's Crisp Sharing Packs or Aero and Rollo 4-packs, now half price. Plus, save more with your 10 or 50 voucher. Dunn Stores, always better value. Terms and conditions apply. Vouchers can be used in next grocery shop, DRS supplies.
Ensure the safety of your team with SafeTech. We have part-funded courses in first aid, people moving and handling, confined spaces, food hygiene, quad bikes, fire warden, IPAF mupes, electrofusion, welding and machinery cards for Ireland and UK sites. Also delivering online courses like utilities, water hygiene and construction supervisors. SafeTech can deliver group training at your business premises. To find out more, contact safetech.ie today.
Why leave the magic moments and great scenes you've captured sitting on your phone when you can have them printed at McGee's Chemist? Using McGee's website or one of their in-store kiosks, you just upload your photos, select the ones you want, and have them printed instantly, within an hour, or use the 24-hour service. 35mm and film from disposable cameras also printed, and old photos can be digitally restored. Hold your memories in your hand with McGee's Chemist, Letterkenny.
Finn Harps and Highland Radio have teamed up to bring you a great value day out on Bank Holiday Monday the 4th of May, when the Harps take on Bray Wanderers at Finn Park. Whether you're a diehard fan or bringing the kids to their very first game, every single ticket, including adults, is just €5. Kickoff is 5 p.m. Bank Holiday Monday at Finn Park. Support local, enjoy the atmosphere and get behind the Harps. Tickets available at finnharps.ie. We'll see you there.
Now, I know sometimes if you take the time out of your day, and we encourage you to do so, and you text in and you feel like your question hasn't been addressed, it's due to the volume of messages we get, and we generally get to them just as soon as we can. So I think one here, for an example, where the listener might felt that we didn't get to it, it's literally just because it was about 48 messages deep. If things are so tight with the defective blocks, could they reuse kitchen, staircases, bathroom sinks, roof trusses and roof slates? People are dumping too much stuff. If your engine went in your car, you wouldn't, you'd get a new engine. You wouldn't get a brand new car. People need to budget more. Everything's gone up 5% due to the oil crisis. Putting in new everything is up by a few thousand. Bathrooms, kitchens, roofing, etc. If the windows are good in a house, they should be kept as they only need to meet the 2012 building regulations. I think that's unless you change your foundations. But anyway, if any of you have gone through that, or you're members of the 100% Redress Party and you want to reply as to why more stuff from the old house isn't reused, please do. Alfie, I think it's Alfie on Facebook, can you please ask Thomas, let me see, where was it, effectively saying that if party members are getting their homes done, is that not against party policies? 100% no less. I wouldn't have thought so, Alfie. I can't speak on behalf of anyone. I think really, even if you're a member of a party or a campaign group, it's down to you what you wish to do. It depends on the type of your house, the nature of your house as well, and also the nature of your income and what resources you have. So whilst it might seem like a contradiction, I suppose they're all just regular individuals as well. And if they can make the scheme work for themselves, as I say, it might be seen as a contradiction, but it's not against any policies or you know, wrong. But I don't know, maybe you disagree. Seamus Gunn of McLaughlin, Gunn's solicitors in Letterkenny and Remelton, joins him now. Hi, Seamus. Lovely to see you again.
Good morning, Greg. How are we?
I'm doing fantastic, actually.
Happy May Day to everybody there.
Happy May Day. I can't wait for the May the 4th be with you jokes that come up every single year in about 3 days' time. Right, so we have another flotilla heading towards Gaza, the Global Summit Flotilla. And there's quite a lot of local interest in relation to this. There's certainly one lady, I think she was in here for a time actually, moved away subsequently, is on that flotilla. The president's sister is on it as well. But there have been some developments in terms of interception ETC. What's your take on these initiatives?
Well, I think the people that are on this, these activists, have to be applauded. They have to be acknowledged. It keeps the spotlight on Gaza, which I think is extremely important. It also shows the muscle of Israel when they can come out into the Mediterranean and intercept boats which are lawfully on the high seas, the 800 or 1,000 miles away from Gaza. So, like, regardless of what the views are on it from the maritime perspective, it's quite interesting, because the Israelis will make the point that they have a lawful blockade to prevent the smuggling of arms. Now, you or I may not accept that. I certainly don't do. But it is an argument that they can put up to justify this, or attempt to justify this blockade on the international law front, we will say. And then against that, the WHO quite rightly are saying that they need or would want to establish some type of a humanitarian corridor in order to get relief in, because relief is not accessing Gaza. And unfortunately, the world media has moved on, but that is just the reality. People are trying to eke out a living in atrocious conditions. You know, the medical supplies, everything is needed in vast quantities, and there's a stranglehold on it by Israel. That is the belief, and I think it's probably borne out by those that have evidenced it. So this flotilla, it's only, 170 plus activists, so maybe 20 odd boats. But once again, though, it brings the attention back on the situation in Gaza, and hopefully then garnishes some support. Now, I was a little bit disappointed in our own response nationally. We have a lot of Irish nationals, quite rightly, you point out, taking part. And Spain are the only country really to come out and decry this and call them, make an official objection to the interception. Now, all these boats, most of them anyway, have now been headed back. I think they've been brought to Greece now. But there are still some out there, and maybe trying to sail on. But this time, Israel are quite cute on it, in my belief, because they have cut them off so far out. There's an element of surprise. The last time there was a big build-up, you might remember, in October, it was going on for weeks, and people were watching it, seeing and tracking their progress, etc. And they got quite close, and at that point, it garnished an awful lot of international attention, and again, correctly so. This time around, they've moved out onto the high seas, but they will say, look, at this blockade, in their belief, was coming for another ulterior motive and not for humanitarian. So that's how they're going to try to justify it themselves. I don't believe they can. But for those that are on it, yes, they have to be applauded and supported. And we can't overlook their 70,000 plus Palestinian lives lost in them couple of years.
And of course, a lot of this is an information war. Israel's foreign ministry stated the operation was conducted peacefully and without any casualties. The flitted organisers, though, said the raid was violent, saying Israeli forces disabled engines, jammed communications and left some participants stranded on broken vessels in the path of an approaching storm 600 miles from Gaza. And I get that. Do you ever wonder, or maybe you know the answer, why we talk about, obviously, Israel and its control of Gaza, and much of Israel runs along Gaza, yet there is land access via Turkey. Why is there not greater movement from Gaza through Turkey? Why isn't there more movement of support for Gazans, through the land-Turkish border? I understand, listen, the flotilla themselves, they admit they're not bringing enough stuff to make a pick a difference, really. It's more to make a point. But I never understand this.
They are hemmed in, but there is this Turkish border here. But the geographic point, really, I think. But it comes back to what maybe I mentioned just at the outset, is that those points of entry, they are still controlled by the Israelis. And that is the issue, the difficulty. And that's when I say it is the grip that they have on that area, that they decide unilaterally what goes in and what comes out. And once that, and Gaza, it is along a strip, the best access may very well be by the sea if they were allowed to come in with the aid that's necessary, because they have got a very long stretch. But the way it is at presently, and who's going to call the Israelis to book, Greg? This is really
one, and that's you referenced
that's
international.
A big issue, really. You know, we're just trying to highlight it, but who would call them to book?
Well, Spain have shown that you can. Really, and I think the Spanish people, when history is written, they'll be held up in very high regard in this, while everyone has sat in their hands. The truth is, there's no international law. Bibi could do whatever he likes. His mate, Donald Trump, is doing the same in Iran. He's talked about destroying an entire civilization. He himself has a potentially illegal blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. It's the Wild West out there.
It is, yes. And unfortunately, it's got to a situation where I believe that nothing shocks us anymore. This is what is actually happening. It moves the world's atrocities move on from A to B. We're now in Iran. We started maybe in Ukraine and moved to Gaza. And now we're in Iran. Consistently, though, and you make this point, but you're right on this. Consistently, Spain have decried all these acts, so they have. They're the one country that stood head and shoulders above other Europeans and coming out and speaking out. And if Europe would at least get in behind them and have a common voice, it certainly would add some momentum to it. But who will hold them to the account? Sure, the International Criminal Court will say, look, they're investigating war crimes, but where will that ever go? Israel will say, look, we're entitled to this blockade. Sure, Trump can say the same thing. And this is the new world order or world disorder. And I think the latter is applicable.
And I think you are right. Let's get closer to home on some listeners' questions. Please ask Seamus, why is it taking 3 years to pay me 80K from my father's estate? Probate has been granted. They believe this is not acceptable.
Well, they should really get in contact with the executor or executors of the estate. They're the parties that are charged. So dealing with it, like in general terms, in relation to probate, when probate issues, that is the official seal to give the authority to the people who are to administer an estate to gather in the assets and distribute them out in accordance with the will. Now, there can be reasons for delay. It could be a difficulty identifying assets, could be a difficulty collecting them in. And that can all lead to time, and a year or two can go by. 3 years can certainly go by. So the port of call, though, if they're looking for answers, is really the people who are responsible. And the parties that are charged with that are the executor or executors of the estate. So that's where they should direct direct their question. It is not unusual in dealing with estates that that sort of period of time can arise. I like to think nowadays we've got very much more efficient. The court services are extremely good at turning around applications for grants and probates currently. So, and that's a big improvement. But it is not unknown, and certainly the executors may be able to set them right on it. There can and usually is, if it's a complicated estate, there can be those type of time periods involved. Mm. Not that extreme.
Yeah. Morning, Greg. Would you please ask Seamus? Our son was in an accident when he was very young and it was settled in court. He's now turned 18. How does he access the money that's sitting in the court's bank, please and thanks?
Yeah, well, I think he's two avenues, Greg. Under the order, the monies that will have been awarded to him in compensation will have been lodged under the court services into the account held by them. So it's for his benefit on he reaching the age of his majority, and he's indicated that now he's come to that. So the two avenues I would suggest to him are he himself could prepare an affidavit and exhibit his birth certificate and lodge it with the court services and make an application to have the funds that are to his credit paid out to him. Or he can engage the services of a lawyer, a solicitor, his own family firm or whatever, to attend to it for him. And obviously there'll be an applicable charge to that. But it's not overly cumbersome. And once he reaches the 18th birthday, he can certainly move ahead with it. But those are his options, I think.
This is kind of an interesting question, because it sounds to me like they don't have a actual basis for opposing this planning permission and are looking for reasons as to why, reasons to scupper it. But anyway, a caller from Northern Ireland has applied for planning permission in Donegal, claiming that they are resident here. They do have a holiday home here, but how do I prove they do not live here?
Oh, well, we go down the route of private investigators or something.
Well, see, that's it. I mean, is it not because the house is too white, or they don't like the design, or the roof is too high, yeah, or it's because they simply want to prove a technicality? I don't know.
That's certainly up to them, and if they can produce evidence to that effect, that's the type of route you might have to be going down, bringing somebody on board, a third party, to check out the entire background. But you can't be abusing the planning process. Like, if there is a genuine concern of an objection, well, of course, you're within your rights to actually lodge that objection and further, in certain circumstances, pursue it to onboard Planala. And interesting, though, at the moment, there is a move to reform the planning acts and planning legislation in relation to developments more in the line of large developments for housing, in light of the need for housing, because an awful lot of these developments can be delayed for upwards of years because of objections to planning, which go to Bord Pleanála, by the way. But then when Bord Pleanála make a decision, what's called a judicial review is sometimes taken by the objector or by the company that they act for or a representative body, which then brings it into the High Court, and there it can remain for some time until it's dealt with and judgment passed on it. And at that point, you're talking about escalating costs with developments, etc. So there's a big move on now to sort of curtail that and streamline it. But, I mean, if one has an objection, absolutely exercise their constitutional rights, mm-hmm. but don't exercise them mischievously.
Last question. My car warranty is not being honoured because I'm 3,000 miles over the warranty specification for the first year. I had the car in to be serviced twice prior to this and it was not mentioned. Can I fight it? Now, it depends whose the onus is on to keep an eye on your mileage and your warranty. But anyway, what say you, Seamus?
Yeah, it's interesting. My understanding is that these warranties have a mileage or a kilometre seal, and I know I'm subject to correction on this, or a year seal, whichever is the lesser, generally speaking. So if you come to your 100,000 kilometres within the 5 years, that's your warranty seal. But if you haven't passed it within the 5 years, your 5 years could be the seal. Mm-hmm. Now, that's my understanding of how they work, and they vary depending on your manufacturer. Some will go some 3, 5 or 7, whatever. So obviously you want to be well versed in that when you're putting your hand in your pocket to pay for a motor car. But as to where they stand, they have outlined the position that they're outside the actual warranty. So they do have a problem there. Can they fight it? Yes, maybe they can fight it, but they haven't indicated what the problem is. Now, if it was a major significant problem that went down to the whether or not this vehicle was suitable at all or had become dangerous as a result of a defect, a significant defect, well, then I think that is an area that you could look at with regardless of the warranty, and maybe looking to the supplier of it in the first instance, who would then probably bring in the manufacturer. But it would have to be significant. If it was the warranty period and you're stuck to that and it's something that would have been covered under the warranty, I think you could be in difficulties.
Lovely stuff, Seamus. Have a great weekend. People can check you out in Letterkenny and Remelton, McLaughlin Gunn Solicitors, and of course online as well, Seamus.
Yes, Greg, we should be there, yeah, gun.ie or DonegalSolicitor.ie. Just look us up. We might even be there at the weekend.
Enjoy it, Seamus. Thank you. We have Shannon Wilkins in studio with us. Wilkins for Scroll Patrol. Hello.
Hi, Greg.
Now, I said to you on Monday, I think when I came back to work after my break, I says, I really enjoyed your conversation with Donal. Lots of interaction there. And you says, yeah, Donal. Knows a lot about music and he likes music. And I went, okay, what do I know a lot about and what do I like? Because you were able to figure it all out very quickly.
You like your lawnmower.
Yes.
And you like Betty, your robot Hoover. So maybe we'll dedicate the rest of the show to them.
But is that, you think that's the sum of my parts?
You like your boat. You do like rappers, but what is it? You like the West Coast ones, not the East Coast ones.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. Yeah.
What else do you enjoy? Beer, but maybe I shouldn't say that.
You can say whatever you like.
What else do you like?
Right, okay. So there's plenty for us to chat about then. Thank you. You actually know quite a bit. I'm impressed.
I do. We spend a lot of time together.
We do actually do long when journeys. You think about it. Nicola Coughlan has been quite busy even after all the hoo-ha. She was in... What's that show?
Bridgerton was her main one.
That was her breakout after Derry Girls, really, wasn't it?
It was. And she's doing a stage adaption of a play at the moment as well.
So okay. And the Dish podcast, what's this? She's on that.
So this is actually a podcast all about food.
Oh,
and I love food.
You do.
But she put a wee bit out there about RIP.ie. So she used to work in an optician's in Galway.
Right.
And she'd be ringing people, hello, I'm just... ringing you because you need an appointment. It's been 2 years since your last eye test. And people would be crying on the phone, this person is dead. And she was like, I can't take any more of this. So before she would go and ring the person, she would search RIP.
Good idea,
and then take
actually.
A look at what year they were born and the names. But she said, funnily enough, the nuns were always still alive.
Mm.
It didn't matter what age they were. She says, nuns are immortal.
It goes to show to their lifestyle because they do have great longevity, no doubt about that. And at least she had the sensitivity because I know it's a light-hearted story of hers, but it does bother people. It's a horrible call to get.
Definitely.
Right. What happens to Instagram after you die, or any of our social medias for that matter?
I know that I have seen in the past Facebook, you can do an in memoriam. I don't know, do you do that yourself before you die or do your family request it? But now Instagram...
I would like it to be like Mission Impossible, do you know, where everything self-destructs 5 seconds after you die?
Just imagine. No photos of Greg. Greg didn't exist. No social media presence. But you can go into your Instagram, into the manage account, and there's a memorialization section. So basically, whenever you die, you can either have a lovely collage of all your photos memorialized, or you just get completely
deleted.
Mine
would just be screen grabs of COVID-19 disease spread figures.
But you have to appoint someone as your legacy contact.
That's it, yeah. Well, do people do that?
So not even like executor of your will. Now you need a freaking legacy contact for your social media.
I don't know.
It's a big job.
I would be very interested actually in people's attitude to that out there, if they do it or don't do it. But I don't want to be thinking about that. Right, Barry Keoghan.
Keoghan.
He's a funny character. He went out with Sabrina.
Sabrina
Strange.
Carpenter.
Do you not notice his image has completely changed over the last 5 years?
Do you know actually what that is?
I thought I had to describe
it. I started doing a big bit of digging. He's clean for 2.5 years.
Okay.
So he actually had a really bad drug problem. He says that he died. Uh-huh. And whenever he died, you know the way people say they kind of have dreams?
Yeah, yeah, visions so and see lights.
He said on one side of him was the flats where he grew up and it was completely in black and white and people were stabbing him. He then realised it was the doctors working on him. And in the distance there was a blonde lady and she was kind of beckoning him to come, but he couldn't get to her and he doesn't know who it was, and he said he kept trying to follow her.
Benny Blanco, sorry, that's a comedian, isn't he?
He is Selena Gomez's husband.
Right, okay.
And as well, whenever he actually, Barry Keoghan was filming The Banshees of Inisherin, that 3 weeks before he started filming, that's when he died. So during the height of his addiction, he was out partying, got smashed by a bottle in the arm, never got it seen to, started getting psychosis. The arm was like inflamed.
Sepsis.
They were scared that it was going to... He says he was in psychosis as well. I don't know what that has to do with it, but he nearly got the arm cut off.
Yeah, not a fella that interests me too much, I'll be honest with you. Chrysler's billionaire butler.
This was really exciting to me because obviously I have a Chrysler connection, so I was really happy.
You don't unfortunately have a millionaire connection.
Not yet, Greg. Maybe someday.
Yeah, maybe.
So there's an account that I've mainly seen on TikTok. It is Donegal Lesser Known Tales. So it's local history, folklore, that kind of stuff. So there is a man called Bernard Lafferty, and he was the former butler to Doris Duke, and he inherited her $1.2 billion estate in America. And he's actually got two movies made out of him as well. So one of them is called Doris and Bernard, and Ralph Fiennes and Susan Sarandon are featured in that. But there was a big kind of fallout at the time if he had a hand in Doris Duke's death. People were accusing him of that, and he had to pay a $5 million settlement to actually claim the money. And then that was in 1993, and then he passed away himself in, I think it was 1995 or 1996. So he didn't get to enjoy it. 1996. So he didn't get to enjoy it that much.
You know who's behind that podcast?
Who?
Our gardener, Paul McLaughlin.
You're joking.
I'm not joking, it is, yeah.
Oh, fair play, Paul.
Yeah, there you go.
You know what? That's his voice too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's it.
I'm so silly.
You're not silly. No, I'm not trying to make you look
well
silly.
Well done, Paul.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Paul.
No, that's how we get the message out. It's a fantastic bit of publicity. Right. And Jimmy Kimmel and the Trumps. This whole American politics thing and, you know, the chat show hosts trying to be too into the whole politics and left versus right, blue versus red. I find it really quite tiresome. But I know a lot of people are out there, right? And I can't set the agenda. So there's more controversy. Is this his comments, widow in waiting?
Widow in waiting, the glow of an expectant widow. So it's kind of a strange comment to make anyway.
But I think Trump had made some similar comment himself about my wife, widow in waiting or something.
Okay.
It is a strange one, but...
Like the glow?
You know, in terms of... These presenters are journalists as well to some extent. I have a journalistic background. And the one basic thing was always never be the story.
Okay.
But they seem to love being the story.
But it got me thinking. I was in a comedy gig last Friday.
And I heard about this.
Some people can get offended over some things. Whenever you go into a comedy gig, you know that somebody's going to get slated. Will it be you? Will it be someone in the media? So
turns out it was you.
It was me. Yeah. And John Breslin got to hear it
He's loved it. He loved that. What's his name? Savage, is it?
Dave McSavage.
Now, he's right on the edge of decency, if not well over it. You and your fiancé were in the front row. Stupid place to sit, I will say.
Well, but we both love attention.
Hammering. Do you?
Yeah, even if it's bad attention, do you know?
Right, I have to pay attention to the clock. Shannon, thank you very much
indeed.
Thank you. That's Shannon Wilkin there. Right, that's where we leave it for the weekend. We're back on Tuesday morning as it's a public holiday. So have a fantastic weekend. Stay safe out there on the road. Someone already clocked doing 111 in a 60-kilometre zone in Bundoran as part of this Garda crackdown, high visibility crackdown. That, you know, we all want to be here on Tuesday morning, don't we? Not being preachy, but let's stay safe.